Let's go to Dude Maker Hotline and talk to the one and only Joe C. Joseph Doyle. Joe, as you know, is communications director for the Friends of the St. Benedict Center. Also, in a similar capacity with the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts, a regular presenter at the St. Benedict Center Conference, and an all-around good Irish lad of Boston himself, and a good Catholic man, friend of this show's, and an authority on these histories of St. Patrick's Day in Boston and other cities like New York. So we always look forward to talking to Joe on our third annual conversation here on St. Patrick's Day. And Irish good morning to you, Joseph.
Good morning to you, Mike, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. So a little bit of family history, Joe. How far back do the Doyles go in Irish folklore?
Well, on both sides of my family, they came to this country, both the Doyles and the Hanburys. My mother's family came to this country in the first decade of the 20th century. The Doyles were from Kerry. The Hanburys were from Galway, from Loughrea in Galway. And my maternal grandfather, Patrick Hanbury, arrived here in 1906. And my paternal grandfather, Cornelius Doyle, arrived I think about 1909. So it was. So we've been in this country about 110, 115 years. So I'm a third generation American.
Third generation American and of great Irish descent. You know, Joe, somebody sent me something the other day on March the 13th. Wait a minute, today 15, 14, 13, 12. On March the 12th, I didn't know this, but on March the 12th, there was a horrific lynching of Italian-American immigrants in the city of New Orleans back in 1890 or something like that. And it shocked so many people, including President William Henry Harrison, that he decided to create a holiday to celebrate Italian-Americans' contributions to America. And amongst the luminaries that he was presented with, he picked Christopher Columbus. I'd never heard this story before until Sunday. And that's how Columbus Day got started. You could say similar things, though, about the Irish, who were also picked on, discriminated against, hated, in many cases beaten and murdered by Americans, especially the Irish Catholics, right?
Yeah, by the way, the issue with Columbus Day was such a terrible thing in New Orleans that we actually, the Italian government, the government of the Kingdom of Italy, actually threatened war with the United States. It was so it was such a severe atrocity during President Benjamin Harrison's time. In Boston, actually, the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick dates back to 1737. Now, there were no Catholics here in Massachusetts then, so this was an Anglican event originally, but there was also tremendous discrimination and hostility to Catholics, particularly Irish Catholics. You recall in the 1850s, nativist movement was at a great height, and in Massachusetts, the so-called Know-Nothings, the American Party, and they were called Know-Nothings because that was their signal and mantra, was that they would say nothing if they were investigated by authorities. The Know-Nothings captured the entire legislature, with the exception of one delegate, one state representative named Byrd from the town of Walpole, and they instituted, among other things, a nunnery inspection committee, where they violated the cloister of a convent, demanding to be let inside and see it in Roxbury, Massachusetts. And the nativists also regained great strength with something called the APA, the American Protective Association, in the 1880s. In the 1890s in East Boston, during one of these nativist events, an Irish Catholic was actually murdered. And as late as 1917, during the American entry into the First World War, who actually had a state representative in Brookline who suggested, because Irish Catholics were opposed to the entry of the U.S. into the war after the execution of Ireland's rebel leaders in 1916, one state representative from Brookline actually suggested that Irish Catholics be taken out and shot. So it was there was a tremendous hostility. The modern parade in Boston, I think, goes back to about 1912, and then in 1946, when James Michael Curley was in his last term as mayor of Boston. He turned it over to the Allied War Veterans Council, who have administered it ever since then. So, again, the leadership of the Allied War Veterans Council was essentially usurped and dispossessed in the end of 2014, the beginning of 2015, through the machinations of the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, soon to be U.S. Labor Secretary. And now Walsh has essentially taken over the Veterans Council. And now, of course, we have one of his former aides, a homosexual activist named Brian Bishop, who was actually the parade marshal. So you not only had the traditional leadership of the Veterans Council usurped and dispossessed, and homosexual groups included, despite the 9-0 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Hurley versus Glid, which was intended to prevent that. But now you actually have a former Walsh aide and homosexual activist actually running the parade now. So this is it's a very sad case of dispossession, where Catholic religious freedom rights were ignored and where a 9-0 U.S. Supreme Court decision was effectively nullified.
And this 9-0 decision was, what was the case you just cited? Because you and I have talked about this before.
It was Hurley versus Glib. The head of the Veterans Council was John J. Wacko Hurley, and he was the one in 1992 who initially refused to allow homosexual groups to march in the parade under their own banners, saying that it was incompatible with the traditional character of the parade and it was incompatible with the wishes of the Allied War Veterans Council, the organizers of the parade. And of course, he lost in every single venue in Massachusetts in terms of there was something like 9 different court jurisdictions, along with the state Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, the civil enforcement agency. Yet he went on to win before a unanimous 9-0 decision in the U.S. Supreme Court. The only dissent in any of these Massachusetts court cases, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled against him, was Associate Justice Joseph R. Nolan, who was a member of the Board of Advisors of the Catholic Action League and was also a great supporter of the St. Benedict Center. And he wrote a blistering dissent, and his dissent was essentially upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, saying it was a violation of the First Amendment, that their ability to control essential to the First Amendment of parade was an exercise in free speech, and the organizers had the right to control their message. And if they did not control their message, then their free speech was impeded. So they had this great Supreme Court decision. It's still on the books, but it was again essentially nullified by Mayor Marty Walsh, who used every imaginable pressure tactic. What they did was they engaged in some parliamentary piracy, bringing people into the Veterans Council when Wacko Hurley had become ill, and they managed to gain temporary control of it. They also used all sorts of economic boycotts and pressure. They threatened to withhold parade permits. They threatened to withhold police protection and actually indicated if there was any bloodshed or loss of life, it would be the fault of the Allied War Veterans Council. They demanded an insurance binder. They demanded they jump through all sorts of legal hoops, which they never had to do before. So again, it was a case where the mayor of Boston effectively nullified a unanimous U.S. Supreme Court decision through, again, every imaginable kind of bullying tactics. So it was a very, very sad day for Boston and a very sad day for religious freedom rights in the United States and a very sad day for the faith. Now, the only good thing about this lockdown is that this year and the year before, St. Patrick's name will not be dragged through the streets in Boston by those who reject and loathe and despise Catholic moral teaching and who reject and loathe and despise the moral code of St. Patrick and castigate that code as bigotry and hatred and homophobia.
We're speaking with Joe Doyle, who's too many titles for me to recount all of them, but the one you'll be most familiar with, he is the communications director for the Friends of the St. Benedict Center. We'll talk about that in just a moment because we're going to talk about one of the St. Benedict centers, the one in Richmond, New Hampshire, just a moment. In speaking with Joe about Boston and City of New York and City of New Orleans and the history of St. Patrick's Day, there is so much history. What the person that's on the fence person that is an agnostic or is an evangelical Christian, maybe a Protestant denominational, what you ought to maybe consider today, and I just throw this out there in humility and charity, is that we're talking about a man that lived in the 4th century. If you're counting, that's depending on whose side you're on and how you count, that's either 1,500 to 1,600 and a half years ago. And yet here today in 2021, and until very recently, we're talking also about a man whose sterling reputation and his reputation as one of the icons of all of Christianity for what he had done. He'd gone into this pagan, human, sacrificial island that was possessed with demons, running all about it, human sacrifice, all manner of evil, and slavery. The people were being captured as far away as what you would call Amsterdam today in the Netherlands, all across the British island there, and they were brought to this island. They were put into slavery, and it was awful what was going on. And this man, who is a newly ordained priest, Catholic priest, goes to, at that time, I don't even know he's a priest. I think he's training to be one. Goes to the island of Ireland and falls in love with the people, gets a calling from God, ultimately goes and begins preaching the gospel. And the island of Ireland is famously converted. The snakes are supposedly driven out. And the rest, as you say, is history here. But we're still talking about St. Patrick's today. You can't go anywhere in any major city where there are Irish, Italian, or Italian Americans, and they have any presence whatsoever, where you're not going to find an Irish pub. And Irish pubs are decorated with what, Joe Doyle? St. Patrick's pictures, St. Patrick's mugs, green clover leaves. The symbology of Ireland, and this is my point is, Joe, the symbology of Ireland and St. Patrick is Catholic, from the crow's ear with the clover at the top.
Well, I mean, bear in mind, St. Patrick, you know, this great devotion to St. Patrick, in France, there are a number of churches named after St. Patrick. In northern Italy, St. Patrick, supposedly was the nephew or the grandnephew of St. Martin of Tours. So there's great devotion throughout the church. The Eastern Orthodox recognize, St. Patrick as a saint, and there's like a kind of a Byzantine icon of St. Patrick. So this St. Patrick is a very well-known saint, was always a very popular saint. And I think, there's a just extraordinary one aspect of his whole life and ministry is that really perhaps nowhere in all of Christendom can an entire nation and its, vast diaspora of descendants throughout the world trace their Catholic faith and culture and of course, their prospect for eternal salvation to the evangelism of a single saint. Our debt of gratitude to St. Patrick is immense and really beyond measure. And this is an extraordinary event that an entire island, an entire country, in the lifetime of a single saint, was transformed from a people who were, were bondsmen of druids who dealt death, and became instead disciples of our Lord, who is the author of life. And I think there's another great aspect, and I think Hilary Belloc, the great Catholic historian, mentioned this, was that, here's Ireland, here's a small country, on whose soil no Roman legionary ever trod. It was never part of the Western Roman Empire, yet it would help really form and shape the whole character of Christendom by its leadership in two of the great kind of civilizational movements of late antiquity and the early Middle Ages. The first, of course, being the preservation of the learning of classical antiquity after the barbarian invasion of the Western Empire. And the second, of course, was the whole evangelization of Europe, which is known to history as the conversion of the barbarians. And it was, of course, Irish monks under the influence of St. Patrick, under St. Columba, St. Columbanus, that evangelized Scotland and northern England, like what would be the ecclesiastical province of York in England. And, of course, it was Irish monks who formed the cathedral school in Paris that was whose in whose foundation that we find the origins of the Sorbonne, and Charlemagne, of course, supported their efforts. And, of course, they evangelized much of Western Europe. So the Irish played a great role as part of the legacy of St. Patrick in the establishment of Christendom and in the Christianization of the former barbarian peoples who had invaded the Western Roman Empire. So the influence of St. Patrick is just quite extraordinary. And, of course, one of the great ironies, Mike, this is perhaps one of the greatest ironies of modern times is the British Empire is long gone in Africa and Asia and elsewhere, but one legacy of it remains, and that's, of course, all the Irish missionaries. So the Catholics in places like Zimbabwe and in Kenya and so many other places in sub-Saharan Anglophone Africa, perhaps the most enduring legacy of the bloody British Empire is the Irish missions and the Catholic populations. The empire is gone, the British army is gone, the British colonial service is gone, but the Catholic Church remains. So this is a great irony of modern times.
And I want to give you another one, Joe Doyle. And many of you people, especially if you've read Christopher Ferrara's book, Liberty and the God That Failed, you'll remember this. Some Irish immigrants that came over into the United States in the 1830s and 40s, I think it was 1840s actually, fresh off the boat, were basically conscripted by the federal cavalry at the time and were sent to go fight in what became the American-Mexican War. And some of them were horrified when they were told to go ransack the monastery, the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe, in the monastery on the top of the hill, and they refused. These men, they even made a movie about it. Tom Berenger was in the movies in the 1990s. They made a movie about this. It's in Ferrara's book. There have been other books written about O'Reilly, I think was his name. The Protestant or the generals that were going to send them into this battle derisively called them the San Patricos for St. Patrick. So.
Yeah, the San Patricios. There wasn't any conscription then in the U.S. in the 1840s. But what happened is many of these immigrants would be, just impoverished, reaching places like Boston and New York. You know, one of the reasons the German settlers, the German immigrants, were prosperous. That's one of the reasons they were able to settle in the Midwest, and you know they could afford the railroad tickets to places like Illinois and Michigan and Ohio. The Irish were completely impoverished and destitute. So that's why so many ended up in the right in the seaport cities like New York and Boston and Philadelphia, and they ended up volunteering in some cases for the U.S. Army, okay. And they were sent to Mexico. Now, I'm not sure it was the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe, but there was tremendous injustice practiced against the Catholic troops. And one of the problems is in some cases they weren't allowed to go to Mass. They weren't allowed there any Catholic chaplains. There was tremendous oppression, and a number of them ended up and they saw, of course, in the Mexican people of Catholic faith and
That's
culture.
Right. That's
and
right.
In many ways, they had more in common with them than the bigots that were discriminating against them and persecuting them for their religion in the U.S. Army. And many of them ended up defecting and fighting for the Mexicans. And I think a number of them were executed by General Winfield Scott.
That's right.
And, yeah, who was the general in chief of the U.S. Army? The leader of them was actually not executed; he was branded, but because he had actually defected before the declaration of war, so he was not guilty of a capital. He was just guilty of desertion. He wasn't guilty of a capital crime at the time of deserting to the enemy. But they were honored in Mexico, and there's an interesting story about that movie. Is that The distribution of that movie about the San Patricios, starring, I think it was Berenger, was largely suppressed through the British influence in Hollywood. And Steven Spielberg had bought the rights to it. And, he's an honorary knight of the British Empire. And, of course, this was released at a time when there was a great deal of trouble in Northern Ireland. And it's very, very interesting that the distribution of this movie was really, which is a great, testament, again, to Irish heroism and to a story of the persecution of the Catholic Church, of Catholic faith in this country. The distribution of that movie was very, very limited. And it's kind of hard to even get a hold of today, but it is an interesting story about, and a true story, largely, about the about the Irish who ended up fighting for Mexico.
Now, Joe Doyle, I got your title right. You're the communication director for the Friends of St. Benedict Center, correct?
I'm the executive director of the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts, and I'm also the communications director for the Friends of the St. Benedict Center.
Okay, so let's talk about Boston and St. Patrick's Day. As you said, maybe the Corona doom is actually doing people a favor by not dragging St. Patrick and his beautiful story and reputation and holiness through the streets of Boston by sodomites. 6 years ago in 2015 is when Matty Walsh pulled the plug on this treachery that allowed these homosexuals in their diapers into the parade. And gloriously and heroically... hang on a second, Joe. I've got a technical issue apparently I have to deal with here.
Sure.
Gloriously and heroically, the sisters of Slaves of the Immaculate Heart of in Still River, who had been for 20-some-odd years participating in the parade and had had a float in it, decided together as a unit, no, we won't do it. This is what Christians are called to do. I will not participate in this defaming and this blasphemy of this saint and this public display of debauchery. These women are heroic. And we have a song that they wrote and performed about all this, but I wanted you to tell a little bit of the backstory because you know it far better than I.
Well, I just, first of all, the Brother Thomas Augustine and from the St. Benedict Center for the Slaves of the Immaculate Mary in the Harvard and Still River, Massachusetts, and the good sisters there certainly are to be commended. They did exactly the right thing. And by the way, they didn't just participate in the parade. Their float of St. Patrick blessing the children was in many ways the iconic symbol out for many, many years of Boston St. Patrick's Day Parade. So everyone, in terms of any of the imagery of the parade, everyone recognized the parade by the famous float that the St. Benedict Center in Still River would have in the parade. And they withdrew after the decision to allow, homosexual groups to march under their own banners, which is a complete negation of the traditional message of St. Patrick's Day. How do you honor a Catholic saint by including those who have been rejected? Joe, for people that can't see this and you're not watching this, one thing I pick up on the video that you got to see, there are three novices in white habits at the time for the Slaves of the Immaculate Heart of Mary in Still River, meaning these were young ladies that were like discerning, they were going through the process of becoming sisters here, yet they obviously are all in about this courageous and brave stand to say, you know what, we love the parade of St. Patrick so much we won't participate in it. So we play that every year, and that will conclude Joe and I's talk about St. Patrick's Day for our third annual. Joe, can you give us an update on what's happening with the Friends of the St. Benedict Center? Before I do this, there's a scandal associated with St. Patrick's Day here in Boston, which I just want
to talk about for
1 minute. There's an annual St. Patrick's Day breakfast in Boston. It was something that harkens back to the days when Bill Bulger, William Bulger, the former president of the Massachusetts Senate, former president of the University of Massachusetts, a guy who was a very strong, loyal, pro-life Catholic, a person very independent, of great independence and integrity. He ran it. Now they're going to have it this Sunday, and now it's just become a kind of a forum for all of these kind of anti-Catholic, since he's left, it's become a forum for all these anti-Catholic politicians, and you're going to have U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who I think your listeners may be familiar with, and Massachusetts Republican Governor Charlie Baker, who's a fanatic for Planned Parenthood, and Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, who's a partnered lesbian who thinks that churches should be treated as public accommodations for purposes of the transgender movement, and Congressman Ayanna Pressley, who you may remember as one of the four members of the so-called Squad, these left-wing extremists, and Congressman Stephen Lynch. And, of course, again, Boston Mayor and soon-to-be U.S. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh. And it's going to be a virtual breakfast this year, but there's going to be another participant. And another participant is going to be the Archbishop of Boston, Cardinal Sean O'Malley. Now, you know, there's a statement by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in 2004, Catholics in Political Life, which said you should not provide honors, awards, or platforms to people who reject fundamental Catholic moral teaching,
right,
as it would give the impression of support for those things. So here is the Cardinal Archbishop of Boston joining, a half dozen militantly pro-abortion, pro-sodomy, anti-religious freedom, politicians who think that nuns should be forced to subsidize contraceptives and sterilizations and abortifacients, who thinks that abortion should be legal, unrestricted, and publicly funded, who thinks Planned Parenthood should be subsidized with taxpayer dollars. I think this is really a very sad scandal. And also bear in mind, the Allied War Veterans Council, when they were fighting to preserve the Christian character of St. Patrick's Day, they reached out to Cardinal O'Malley, and he refused to meet with them. He rebuffed them. He actually, and I think this was a very demeaning thing to do, he actually referred them to his PR flack, to his public relations spokesman, Terrence Donlan. And so they never got any support from the Archdiocese of Boston in their struggle to, again, preserve the Catholic character, the Christian character of St. Patrick's Day. And now he's actually joining with two of the men responsible for destroying the Catholic character of St. Patrick's Day, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who again used every kind of imaginable bully tactic and pressure tactic to dispossess the Allied War Veterans Council, and Congressman Stephen Lynch, who was Walsh's collaborator in this. So this is just very tragic and just inexplicable. I don't know what the Cardinal thinks he gains by cavorting and publicly fraternizing with the enemies of the church, but this seems to be the pattern of his episcopate here in Boston.
Well, I tell you, there's a pattern with far too many people, even outside of Boston. Joe, what's going on? Any update on what's happening with the Friends of the St. Benedict Center?
Well, first of all, the Friends of St. Benedict Center would like to thank Lonnie Brennan of the conservative Massachusetts newspaper, the Boston Broadside, who was good enough to publish our news release, Diocese of Manchester Changes Its Tune, about, the persecution of the St. Benedict Center by the very troubled Diocese of Manchester. Your listeners may know by now that the St. Benedict Center, which is an island of orthodoxy in the church, this is the St. Benedict Center and the Slaves of the Immaculate Heart of Mary in Richmond, New Hampshire, which is an oasis of sanity and an island of orthodoxy in the church, and which is one of the few Catholic institutions which is actually growing and converting people and bringing people to the faith and bringing people back to the faith, and which has been completely untainted by the kind of scandals that have occurred throughout the rest of the church. That's being essentially persecuted and by the very troubled Diocese of Manchester. The Diocese of Manchester is actually trying to suppress it. They came out with these without warning, without any dialogue. You know, this is the church of dialogue, supposedly, and we're supposed to be pastoral in our approaches, but without warning, without any dialogue, they imposed these really draconian precepts of prohibition on them in 2019, which was intended to effectively destroy them, effectively suppress them, effectively end their religious ministry altogether. And They deprived them of a priest and of the sacraments, and they boarded Catholics to no longer attend their wonderful Catholic school, Immaculate Heart of Mary School. They even ordered them to go to the IRS and go to the New Hampshire Secretary of State's office and disavow that they were a Catholic organization. So this is a really terrible thing that's been done. And then just in the last few months, we had there was a kind of a change of tune. Suddenly, their controversial canonist, Father George Dallaire. And by the way, I point out the Diocese of Manchester is really one of the more troubled jurisdictions in the Catholic Church in the United States. You know, we've had even though it's a fairly small diocese, you've had 73 priests and monks and friars and brothers, credibly accused of sexual abuse. You have a former bishop, John McCormick, a former auxiliary bishop, Francis Christensen, who were known for, reputed to have moved these molesters around. The former chancellor and public face of the diocese, Monsignor Edward Arsenault, ended up going to prison. Apparently, he was diverting church funds for the benefit of his same-sex paramour. And another priest, Father Edward Lower, who was a friend of Arsenault's, ended up committing suicide after he was accused of abuse. So this is a very troubled jurisdiction, and their canonist, who has apparently been the person you might say is the point man on their dealings with the St. Benedict Center, and seems to be very, very hostile to the St. Benedict Center. He suddenly announced that the bishop was solicitous towards them, and he was concerned about them, and they were Catholics, and now he was concerned about their spiritual welfare. Now how that is consistent with publicly criticizing them and continuing this regime of persecution is I think not apparent. But then, after saying this, and we wondered at the time, was could this possibly be some kind of deliberate misdirection with the ultimate intention of even more punitive responses? Suddenly, after saying this, then Father Dallaire filed a lawsuit, not against the St. Benedict Center, though he mentions them rather extensively in the lawsuit, but against Michael Voris of Church Militant, claiming that he was defamed, because Voris criticized Father Dallaire and criticized the Diocese of Manchester and defended the St. Benedict Center. So Michael Voris obviously is someone that is the name of his organization is Church Militant, and he certainly conducts himself on that basis. And it's unlikely he's going to be intimidated by this kind of lawsuit.
No.
It's very, very hard under the Sullivan rules to prove, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision about Sullivan versus the New York Times, to prove defamation if you're a public figure. I understand Father Dallaire's lawsuit claims that he's not a public figure, but of course he is, the vicar for canonical affairs of the Diocese of Manchester, and he is a pastor of a parish there, and he has appeared in the media a number of times. He has this a friendly reporter named Damian Fisher in the Union Leader, who has written all these stories, maligning the St. Benedict Center, and he's been in a number of them and made various charges against the St. Benedict Center. So whether the courts will view him as a public figure or not, I think remains to be seen, but I think that's a very high hurdle to overcome. But so as of right now, again, you have actions are the message they're making of suddenly being conciliatory. This message that they put out in the last story that appeared in the Union Leader is now contradicted by this very, very kind of harsh lawsuit that's being filed by Father Dallaire against Michael Voris and Church Militant, and also against a girl named Anita Carey, who was a former reporter for Church Militant. So again, it's very, very hard, I think, to repose trust in anything that the Diocese of Manchester does, because we get this very sudden and draconian imposition of these prohibitions on the center, all sorts of public criticisms of the center. And again, this is the here you have St. Anselm's University and St. Anselm's College and Riviere University in the Diocese of Manchester that engage in all sorts of heterodox and scandalous behavior, have homosexual groups on campus that are recognized and funded, that have various same-sex events and all sorts of activities that are completely incompatible with Catholic moral teaching, and the bishop tolerates these, but he won't tolerate an Orthodox traditionalist group that is actually, again, bringing people to the faith.
It's an outrage. It's an outrage, and it has been. Yeah. Hey, Joe, we're out of time. What is the website for St. Benedict, Friends of St. Benedict Center?
FOSBC.org, Friends of St. Benedict Center.org. And you can reach them. You can also see this latest article that appeared in the Boston Broadside. And you can also reach the Catholic Action League at CatholicActionLeague.org. So I encourage people to go to the website of the Friends of St. Benedict Center. It talks about the mission of the Friends. It talks about that. It also has a list of our various you know, media appearances and all of our different newsletters and news releases and letters to the editor. And other things, and I think you'll find also will give a good history of the persecution of the, this completely unwarranted and unjustified, and very uncharitable persecution of the St. Benedict Center by this by the Diocese of Manchester, which again is one of the more troubled Catholic jurisdictions in the United States.
All right, he is Joe Doyle, and again, he is a regular contributor or a regular speaker at the St. Benedict Center Conference, regular guest here. Whenever we have an issue of anything to talk about in Boston, and Boston, whether it has to do with the St. Benedict Center or the Knights of Columbus or whoever it may be, we always call on Joe. And Joe, thank you as always. By the by, Joe, my daughter that lives in Boston informed me yesterday, she was very excited that, because she lives in Brighton, actually. She said, Dad, you're going to love this. She goes, I had a interview with St. Elizabeth Hospital yesterday. And I went, oh, St. Elizabeth. And I said, well, I don't know how Catholic is. And she goes, well, I don't know either, but all I can tell you is when I walked in the lobby, I went to a chapel. I said, hey, we'll take it. We'll take it.
St. Elizabeth's was part of was a Catholic hospital that was part of the Caritas Christi system, and they ended up selling that off to something called Steward Healthcare,
right,
which agreed to maintain the Catholic character. But I'm afraid they haven't really kept that promise, as we all knew. And St. Elizabeth's, somebody told me they took down much of the religious imagery, took out the statues, took out many of the crucifixes on the walls. I'm not sure if there's any kind of, there's still a chapel. How much Catholic religious iconography is there, I think, remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But it isn't really, it's now run by a for-profit secular corporation. Who has signed this agreement saying that they will preserve the Catholic character. But the Steward Healthcare, the other hospital, the Kearney Hospital, the other Catholic hospital, they fly the rainbow flag in June. So Steward is not to be trusted. But the Archdiocese made this deal with them, knowing they weren't to be trusted. So I think the primary culprit here again is I'm afraid Cardinal O'Malley and the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Boston, which pretty much James Karam, who was the chairman of the board, said at the time. He said he told the Cardinal insisted the Catholic character would be observed. Yet this was contradicted at a public hearing by James Karam, the chairman of the board, who said, I told the Cardinal we can't guarantee that the Catholic character will continue under the new regime. So,
well, there's that.
Again.
Yeah. All right, Joe, thank you very much. Happy St. Patrick's Day, and God bless. Thank you.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, and happy St. Joseph's Day to you, Mike.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Bye.